Hello, everyone. I think we're going to go ahead and get started and fiddle with the light issue as we go, if you're okay with that. And optimally, we can dim the lights or get the lights off for better viewing of the slides. But we're looking for a lamp that Professor Stafford can use to read her lecture if we do cut the lights.
Not
greetings. Sorry?
I said not going to read it, just to see it.
Just to see it. Greetings, everyone. Thanks for being here. This is a wonderful size audience we have. I love it when we have to go get the folding chairs to accommodate everyone. My name is Tim Knepper. I teach philosophy and religion here at Drake, and here comes the lamp. And I also direct the Comparison Project, which is a public program in comparative religion. The core programming of the Comparison Project is a year-long series of lectures by scholars of religion, interfaith dialogues involving practitioners in the community, and panel reflections by philosophers of religion, all of which concern a particular theme. Last year, for our inaugural year, we took up the theme of religious responses to suffering. This year, our theme is religion beyond words. And I'm pleased that we're doing more than just religious phenomena this year, since the issue of ineffability, that which transcends language, comes up also in art and music and poetry, so forth. We're also doing some lectures that explore ineffability in those discourses. We're generously funded by six sources, and I want to thank them all: the Drake Humanities, the Drake University Humanities Center, the Drake University Principal Financial Group Center for Global Citizenship, Humanities Iowa, Cultivating Compassion, the Richard Denning Fund, the Des Moines Area Religious Council, and the Medbury Fund. And I need to tell you, and take off my glasses to do so, that the opinions expressed here do not necessarily reflect those of these supporters. One of our supporters, and now we do the binder dance. One of our supporters, Humanities Iowa, insists for us to take attendance at our events. If you'd be so kind, if only to write your name on this. If you want to be on our emailing list or their emailing list, there's a line there for you to provide your email address. If you think you're on our emailing list but not getting our emails, that's because we couldn't read your handwriting. So, and if you are getting our emails, no need to give us your email address again. I'll start this now. Many thanks. If you'd like more information about our program, we have some brochures over there. There are also some brochures for Humanities Iowa. And Humanities Iowa invites evaluation of our events, and there are some evaluation forms if you have some time afterwards to evaluate tonight's event. Tonight's event: Paying Attention, the Fine Art and Neuroscience of Visual Awareness by Professor Barbara Stafford. We're honored to have Professor Stafford with us tonight, and also to have a response to Professor Stafford's lecture by our very own Lenore Metrichen, Associate Professor of Art History. Lenore and I have been working together over the summer and on into the semester on conversations regarding ineffability in religion and art, and it's just been tremendously eye-opening for me. Thanks so much. Barbara Maria Stafford is an independent writer, curator, and speaker. She's currently the Distinguished University Visiting Professor at the Georgia Institute of Technology School of Architecture. Prior to that, she served as the William B. Ogden Distinguished Service Professor at the University of Chicago. She is the author or editor of numerous books, at least 9 by my count, the most recent of which is The Field Guide to a New Meta-Field, Bridging the Humanities-Neuroscience Divide, published in 2011 by University of Chicago Press. Her work in general explores the intersections between the visual arts and the physical and biological sciences from the early modern to the contemporary era. More particularly, her current research charts the revolutionary ways the neuroscience are changing our views of the human and animal sensorium, shaping our fundamental assumptions about perception, sensation, emotion, mental imagery, and subjectivity. In tonight's lecture, Professor Stafford will tackle a comparatively understudied and relatively under-researched area in contemporary neurosciences, an area where the imaging side of the humanities has much to contribute. This is the importance of selective attention. What are the inducements for attending carefully to the subtleties of the world? Please join me in welcoming Professor Barbara Stafford.
I think maybe I should be plunged into darkness. Let's test it.
Okay.
That is, I'm mindful I'm speaking to philosophers, not metaphysical, but physical darkness, please. Thank you. A slight problem. It's a bit dark, is it not? Sort of ready for Halloween.
Do you think this will possibly...
Do you think we can do that? Hang on, let's move this guy. Can we move this?
Now this is really ineffable.
The trouble is the desk is slanted. We'll figure it out. We'll figure it out. It's all right. It's all right.
No.
Not even Mallarmé did that in his famous Oxford lecture.
This will stay there as long as you don't move in this direction.
You know what? All I need is light coming up. Just give me that chair, would you? Let's try that. I just need to see. I'm not reading my lecture.
Barbara, it might be a three-way bulb.
But I think it's better because then we have the other problem again. Thank you. Maybe let's try flipping it up the bulb. Yeah, I don't want backlight. That's what I would like to try and avoid.
Some more books here.
You know what? Let's put some books under here.
Right. Hey, Carl, would it be all right if I grab some?
Yeah.
Congressional record.
Excellent. No, one of my wonderful PhD students wrote this lovely sort of reevaluation of the great symbolist poet Stéphane Mallarmé, and she worked on these enigmatic manuscripts of his that he did at these lectures, supposedly at Oxford. And he, the great arcane poet, actually rearranged furniture and put a lamp and a table. Would that I were in the same league. I think let's try this. Okay. And I hope. If worse comes to worse, let me know, please, because I do have some really good material. Thank you so much, Tim. Thank you so much, Lenore, for this lovely invitation. I've been struggling, actually, for the last several years with this sort of with the problem, the possible interrelationship between the neurosciences and particularly the visual side of the humanities. Those of you who are interested in the new philosophy of mind and so on know that linguistics looms rather large, but I'm interested in the visual component. I'm also mindful of Tim's directive. I know that he is a philosopher of religion. I actually trained in continental philosophy, so I'm rather proud of that and have never let it go, so I hope some of that perhaps might show this evening. But what I really, as I said, have been struggling with since my last two books that looked at this interrelationship between the neurosciences and the visual side of the humanities is the problem of vanishing attentiveness, not just attention, but attentiveness. And I want to put it in relationship to this problem of subtlety in the elusive, and that which really exceeds or evades language. So let me just say that for starters. And this is for you, Tim. This is a quote from W.H. Auden, not what he's most famous for, of course, his poetry, but rather for his somewhat understudied religious writings. And I want to show it to you in relation to this work by the German Romantic painter Philipp Otto Runge. And this is Auden. To pray is to pay attention, or shall we say to listen to someone or something other than oneself. Whenever a man so concentrates his attention, be it on a landscape, as in the case of Runge, or a poem, or a geometrical problem, or an idol, or the true God, that he completely forgets his own ego and desires in listening to what the other has to say to him, he is praying. Auden continues to say that what he's talking about is non-petitionary prayer. In other words, you're not asking for something. Instead, it is more akin to wonder, the classical sense of wonder, and to adoration. These light genie figures who are absolutely in the moment, present. Perhaps another way I could put it is a kind of intent focus. I want to jump ahead. I'm going to come back to the Runge, but I want to just sort of lay out the field, as it were. I want to jump ahead to a contemporary installation, very interesting work, curated by the Czech artist Katarina Seda, which shows her grandmother. The installation actually was a series of drawings, and you see her grandmother actually in the process of making them. This whole installation was prompted by the fact that her grandmother, Jana, after the death of her husband, no longer dressed, no longer washed, no longer went out, ended up only watching television. And her granddaughter, who is an artist curator, had her begin this project. This project, which asked her to remember. And to remember her years before her marriage, when she actually, I suppose for the Home Depot of Brunn in Czechoslovakia, she was the manager of the home product section. And what's extraordinary is that she produced over 650 drawings that are, as you see, and I'm going to come back to this also in a moment, rather parsimonious. They are diagrammatic drawings of things like putty knives, saw blades, spanners, mops, ladders, you name it. And I want to introduce, having said that, a second component that is a neuroscientific component into our consideration with the concept of neuroaesthetics. Neuroaesthetics received a formulation in the 1990s by the still great French neurophilosopher Jean-Pierre Changeux. The philosophers here probably know him because he carried on many conversations with Paul Ricoeur about the mind, about religion, about the concept of reason and pleasure. And it's Changeux that helps us get a different entree into the problem of attention, but also this very interesting potential relationship between the neurosciences and the humanities on the matter of attentiveness. Changeux was interested in discovering what he called the neural correlates of aesthetic experience, and he developed something called the workplace theory. The global workplace theory. I'm not going to go into that except to say that what is so important about his philosophy, I think, what I find very moving and helpful, is that he argued that the most highly synthetic and unified, this is the part I want to stress, mental representations are situated in the prefrontal cortex, and works of art speak to that. That is, there is something about works of art that unify you at a fundamental cortical level. More importantly, it brings together the limbic system, our oldest system, the so-called brain of the emotions, with these higher order functions. Creative activity for Changeu is also very much involved with memory, ergo my reason for showing you this. That is memory, and especially, there are of course many, many kinds of memory, but especially the ways in which long-term memory gets focalized in present, current memory is very much fostered by the creative act, by creative activity, exactly what you see happening in the case of Jana, whose wonderfully insightful granddaughter had her actually perform that very act, that is, bring up the past and focalize it and localize it in conscious memory processing. And that's really my theme. We know that almost 90% of all brain functions are on automatic pilot. People like Antonio Damasio have studied that. I mean, it's absolutely necessary. You can't run the homeostatic system if every second you have to stop and breathe. It is that narrow band of conscious will, if you will, of conscious attention, that I want to that I want to mine, as it were, in my lecture. So memory processing as a salient element in this neuroaesthetics model, first proposed by Jean-Pierre Changeu, continued by Stanislas Dehaene, really foregrounds the work of art, and especially the work of visual art, as requiring voluntary and conscious retrieval of long-term memories. And this is kind of a rarity in the literature that I've read about, where so much people like Semir Zeki are interested in optical illusions and all this material, in all these reactions that are, if you will, instinctual, where you have no control over them, whether you want to or not. So I want to mine this other side. A side, by the way, that many great romantic philosophers, Novalis, Schlegel, the Schlegels, and Fichte were particularly interested in. So, all right then. This act of retrieval, we also know that what gets remembered is never totally a recapitulation of the original moment. It never is. It is rather governed by this concept of parsimony. Again, what you see here, it is the outline, the diagram that comes back to us at a certain level. The other point I want to make, because attentiveness is also a social practice, or the lack of it, is a social neglect. Something that it seems to me is so beautiful about this installation work is that Katharina Seder shows that art at some level illuminates the process of how we attend to someone else. In that sense, of course, it is also a deep social practice. It is also a lovely demonstration, if you will, of the plasticity of the neural networks, the fact that we now know that the brain needs exercise until the very end. If you don't exercise it, you lose it. Or I quote the wonderful dancer, the comment by the dancer Yvonne Rainer, who reminds us, the mind is a muscle. So if you don't use it, it is gone. But let me return to Auden's prayer analogy and return to this is a small morning. There's a much larger unfinished one by Philipp Otto Runge and in the Hamburger Kunsthalle. And it is, for the religious historians, it is, of course, immediately an example of Christian agape, that is shared but unerotic love, importantly defined as where one is invaded by an irresistible power that one consents to and rejoices in. And I'm going to kind of develop this. I hope this fact that there is a consensualness about it, and you'll notice that it's also wordless. It is something that is larger than the text. It is then, at a profound level, the opposite of human indifference. I want now, again, and I'm going to do this throughout my lecture, I want to segue between the past and historical document and also the present, and make an important point that it, especially in light of our current cultural landscape, there is a profound difference between the concept of automaticity, that is something that comes out of cybernetics, Herbert Simon, Norbert Wiener, and what you see here, this rather wonderful concept of the romantic idea of biology, but very pertinent to us today, and that is spontaneity. Spontaneity has today been conflated with the notion of speed and automaticity. Spontaneity comes not out of a machinic discourse, but out of biology and the imagination. And Buffon, for example, in his great Histoire naturelle, said that is, in fact, how life is formed and shaped out of those processes. And I stress this because Rumet knew these folks, and these children blossoms emerging in this meta frame, there's a frame within the frame here, is really rather a perfect visual summa of the concept of organicism in that deep biological spontaneous sense. I want to stress this because of the confusion. And the critique, of course, is out there. Computers, of course, on one hand, are technologies of liberation. But I quote, very interesting quote by the great film director Stanley Kubrick, it has become a machine to monitor and manipulate people. It's not that computers start to act like people. Rather, it's that people start to act like computers. And, of course, it's the speed aspect that he is highlighting. This is Nicholas Carr from a book published by MIT called Does IT Matter? We are transferring our intelligence into the machine, and the machine is transferring its way of thinking into us. And again, this is a critical one. We are beginning to process information as if we are nodes. Of course, what I'm trying to set up in some way is the difference between an attention that is seized, that is determined from the outside by someone else, by something else, as opposed to the kind of willed attention that Changeux and Ricoeur originally, and other people now as well, originally laid out. I want to show you a series of seven photographs by the photographer Philip Toledano and say this is not my subject. You obviously, I mean, everybody, I'm sure in the audience, realizes you're looking at enraptured, captive, or ensnared computer game players. Well, you probably, it's interesting, they're, of course, of a certain age, they're male, they're probably engaging in playing first-person shooters. I'm knowing all of this now that I'm at Georgia Tech. But anyway, my point is to make the distinction that what we have here are people who are captive, to be sure, but without aware, without being aware that they are aware. I'm going to use the language of film theory. It is what we have happening here is the inability to pause or still the image. You can't stop it. Continue using the language of film, the inability to fade to black because the nervous system is so overstretched at a point of exhaustion and fatigue that it cannot elastically go back. This is a phenomenon we know from the study of addiction, by the way, especially something called and also extreme memory, which plays a role in addiction, which is this extraordinary fact that people who have been off of drugs or sex or whatever forever, when suddenly fall back, and they fall back worse than they were before. Why is that? Well, this is one reason. Anyway, let me, having said that, go back to Norbert Wiener and the concept of cybernetics. This is from a recent memoir, his recent memoir called Ex Prodigy. Humility was never his great gift. Anyway, what he is writing about there, and he's, of course, the first really extensive designer of the concept of cybernetics. He coined the term. He's writing about especially self-referential, probabilistic forms of thought connected with theories of messages and communications. And cybernetics, as defined by him, is the science of control or prediction of future action, as well, and this is quite important because it's come to pass, as well as a science of form entailing intention-detecting processes. Things have gone way beyond Norbert Wiener's prediction. That is, ways in which surreptitiously, in clandestine fashion, we now know that the action of others can be processed without them knowing it, knowingly or unknowingly. Well, what's happening is more and more unknowingly. And it is this, of course, that feeds very much into computer gaming. Having said that this is not my subject, I need to posit it, or at least to show it to you, to turn back to my subject, which is to say, how can we get the mind science of the humanities, which used to be involved or imbricated in psychology, and the brain science of neurobiology together? And I want to do it now this way, with also addressing this issue of the subtle, the elusive, the ineffable, that which vision can do. If we actually look at how human beings behave when they involve themselves in more complex activities, if we actually observe them, not the way a neuroscientist does from the bottom up, but from the, if you will, from up to the bottom, and I'm thinking of things like thinking, communicating, observing, we notice that people hesitate. They don't, again, a concept that is almost gone. They hesitate. Not only do they hesitate, they slow down. There's something about that selective focalization that makes you hesitate, makes you slow down. It makes you, again, engage in this intent focusing, and I intend the pun. So if I were to rephrase what my topic today is, it's the value of slowness, slow art, slow looking, captured in the lovely phrase of Umberto Maturana and Francisco Varela, to live is to know. And they mean by this that human interaction is based on the present moment, of meaningful experience. It's in the relation. As the great American pragmatist William James Dewey actually also points this out, it's not about subject, it's not about the object, it's about the event. It's about that which happens and that is so elusive, it's so difficult to grasp. I'm showing you here, this of course is my subject, I'm showing you here a photograph by Annie Leibovitz of the Japanese architect Kazuyo Sejima, intently actually examining a model of her recent Museum of Contemporary Art in the Bowery in New York. And I want to, for a moment, a focus on the situation. There's something situationist about this, something invent, an encounter which also shows someone thinking. And it's there that I'm heading, and the different varieties of thought. She is looking, she's examining at the maquette of this two-ply exterior, which is, the outer skin is metal, perforated metal, by the way. And Leibovitz was quite brilliant because she shows that depending on where the light source is, whether it's in shadow or in direct light, you get this incredible chromatic gradation between bright silver and these subtle grays, also depending on the weather. And when the sun comes out, as in the back, you get a mirage. In other words, it takes time, that pregnant moment, to see all of the various incarnations. This is actually, let's take a look at Kazuyo Sejima's and make the point that there is a whole new architecture and art out there that at some level is, to my mind, much further advanced than actually art historical theorizing about it. This is her addition, also taken, by the way, by Annie Leibovitz, which is why it's so brilliant and in a way so enigmatic. The Toledo Museum of Art, it's their new addition, a glass pavilion designed by Kazuyo Sejima, and we say, well, what kind of space is this? At first blush, you might think you're looking at mid-century Philip Johnson. We're looking at just another glass box, you know, that you look through. Again, in the event, what is the event? What is the situation? She has, by bowing out certain of the glass forms, has created something that absolutely obstructs a direct flow through of vision. Instead, she creates again, it's difficult to put in words, it's not the modernist see-through glass box. This undulating glass surface instead creates these enigmatic spaces where the eye is forced to linger, and I want to stress that. In other words, it's willful. It's a piece of architecture made for a world where nobody lingers, nobody hesitates, or hardly anyone does over anything. And she does it also by creating this kind of hovering sense. You have a sense of forms hovering one within the other. So here you have a contemporary architect taking a form that at first blush and really rethinking it in a profound way in light of this realization. Here is another, and I'm told I have to see it tomorrow morning on the way to my airport, the brilliant new earthworks, ecologically minded artist. This is Andy Goldsworthy. Andy Goldsworthy also totally revolutionizing, shifting The way we think of what earthworks, earth art is. Those of you who remember the great heroic macho developments of the 1960s, Robert Smithson digging up a labyrinth in the Utah desert, Michael Heiser creating cairns, animal cairns. This is not that at all. It is about training a new kind of perception in a world, a new kind of attentiveness, if you will, in a world that has forgotten it. You have barely touched Earth. The only thing that makes you realize that you're really looking at a work of art, not a work of nature, is because of the saliency, the fact that the cone of autumn leaves, because they're geometric, is something that is a thwart of the natural world. And the work itself becomes simply the process of watching the leaves blow away. Another example here also by Andy Goldsworthy, although reminiscent of some of the experiments by Judy Chicago in the 1970s, where she simply released colored smoke in the Arizona desert and watched as it moved away. You have to watch because you can't predict. The motion is entropic. You can't predict, so it forces you to stay with what? With a kind of lingering delicacy, with a subtlety, again, that is always on the verge of being distilled into nothingness or evaporating. There are also new filmmakers who are interested, and I'm shifting now, in what we might call the power of smaller and smaller movements, all of which, movements that are so small they even evade the eye saccade. They almost occur in the gap. This is the British filmmaker Peter Hutton, and it is an image of a video made of a fjord in Iceland, and the entire image happens only at the interface or at the horizon line where water and sky meet, and the trembling motion that occurs at the edge. Entirely different kind of work that has arisen now. Has anyone seen Steve McQueen's Shame, the movie Shame? Kind of an art. Anybody? Yeah, brilliant study actually of sexual addiction, which could have been done, could have been filmed without a word. And when I got out of it, this is actually by Steve McQueen, 17 minutes only. It's not his one Hollywood picture, which was about an hour and a half. But I hadn't been that way in a movie for a long, long time, that every scene was so constructed that you didn't realize how exhausted you were until you got out. That is the power of those particular images. I want to do this, speak about this one in particular. This one's quite a different production. It's an art film, and he is primarily an art filmmaker, not a Hollywood director. It's a film that he made, as I said, 17 minutes, simply called Gravesend, because I want to make a point about this text image difference in a minute. It's densely packed, as I suggested Shame is too. This is the very first image that you get. It's the only one I'm going to show you. I show it to you. It has an almost vintage look to it. It reminds you of a camera, of a magic lantern slide. And actually, the only action in this opening is simply as in those 19th century magic lantern shows, the setting sun slipping and rising, falling and rising behind a cloud. The film is about the mining of coltan, which is short for columbide tantalite, a mineral so valuable, we know that it's the new blood diamond because 90% 90% of the world's production is in Rwanda, and it is also central to all computers, to many of our PDAs, and it is constructed, I'm sorry, more of you didn't see shame, but it's constructed in the same way. It goes from here, from this shipyard dock scene to the bottom of the earth, to the miners in Rwanda, and then up to the processing of this particular of this particular mineral. And it begins, as I said, with this incredible lyrical slow time dissolve that rivets you and gets you in and perhaps allows you to remember that you've heard the term Gravesend before. It is, in fact, where it's a town in Kent, England, where Marlowe, the protagonist of Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness, set sail for the Congo. And McQueen says, this time-lapsed footage of this very slow rising and sinking of the sun set against this hazy harbor was inspired by the first paragraph of Conrad, where Conrad speaks of the imperceptible fall and curve of the sun, which, if I want to talk about the difference between the visual and the verbal, where perhaps that phrase, which is so evocative still, doesn't capture that foreboding melancholy. Everything hinges on that first paragraph in terms of what happens to Marlowe. Set here, and then the following constructions of the scene. So I put that out again to say how something so elusive can be captured by an image. And an image that is not an illustration of a text. I mean, this isn't an illustration of Conrad. It's rather the creation of something more. I thought what I would do next is perhaps to do return to my promise, which is to do perhaps a typology, and ask, what is it that we can tell about the nature of thought, about thinking, about, again, this attentiveness that one pays to the world by looking from the outside in? And I'm hopefully beginning, you'll think in a witty fashion, by somebody trying to screw in a light bulb. And ask, what can we tell about internal processes by looking at the outside? Intellectual, what is an inquisitive look, if we think of this whole range of terms that philosophy and literature have? What about it? And you notice that the acuity, everything centered on the action and also the tying together, something more that, again, I don't have enough time to go into, but the way in which the haptic and the visual, the motor system and the visual system are tied together in this particular process. This is my homage to Kant, if we think of Kant's third critique, the critique of judgment, what is judgment. What is it? It doesn't exist as a faculty. It is rather the product of a relationship. And if you look at a face like this, eyes rolled to the side, that is, Kant makes it clear that that judgment is about a comparison. It's again about a situation. You're comparing things that are not necessarily comparable, but to which at some level you have to adjudicate. You've got to figure out the bringing in of the peripheral region and also the holding in abeyance. Let's take a look at this. Moving from the diagnostic to bringing in this whole industry of the philosophy of the emotions and affect, what does one do with something like this? What kind of an image is this? And what does it say? What or does it say at all? A lot of both, as I was trained in continental philosophy, but I now read a fair amount of Anglo-American philosophy. Of course, Hume is still very big on the scene. When you get into the emotions, you remember the importance of passion to Hume and the emotions, and especially the problem that he ran into with mixed emotions. So what are we looking at here? What stops us in our tracks, and what can we tell about what's going on inside? I'd say the first thing is that whatever's going on here is not based on impulse. It's not that it's not based on some speedy instinctual reaction, nor is it based on an automatic reflex. We know that. That just is there. So what is it? Well, for one thing, it's not one thing or the other. It's quite a few things about the emotions. One could say it is a person sunk into herself, and I'm going to end all of this by asking, where is thought? There's a big debate about where it is. But this person has gone on some kind of inner journey. It is mixed, you could say, remorse, regret, perhaps even the reviewing of one's life, doing exactly again what Changeux says, unified, however, in a particular moment. Shame. All of these things that language at some level struggles with, I'm struggling with in the act of interpretation, but we ask what is there before us. All right, perhaps somewhat analogous, but it allows me to bring in synesthesia. George Bernard Shaw is known as a great, obviously, man of the theater, social critic, but he was also a photographer. And this is an early photograph of his, and it reminds us that in many of the European languages, weight, the haptic, is involved with thought. Ponder, choice, ponderation, a kind of heaviness that begins to affect this person who is, we know he's a jurist, but embarked on some kind of inner immigration where we can't touch it, but where we can't touch or identify or speak the thought, but you see it. You see it sinking in. A kind of pondered choice. One could go on and on. I would be remiss if I didn't speak about the pathologies. And I have two that I want to bring before you. And this is actually interestingly done by Warren Needy. He is a artist living in Berlin who was trained at Caltech in cognitive science. And it is a study of voyeurism. If we say that these looks that are long, longing, but that are that become pathological, a kind of pathological focus. Warren makes us realize that the naturalness of the way the visual system and the motor system are really profoundly, those cortices are profoundly connected, and what happens when you break it, when you freeze the motion, and don't keep, don't make it embodied. It's actually rather a perfect example of that malaise, the postmodern gaze. Here is another side of Niedig's work. So a different kind of lengthy look that gets us into the world of obsession. I'm mindful myself that I was going to say something about eroticism. I'm not, except to say that another way of asking these questions would be really interesting, and I ask my students to do it, is to say, what types of things do we want to be acutely awake for? What experiences, what events, what situations? And then go and examine the result. Of course, sexuality, in the Roman de la Rose, le doux regard, gentle looking, a looking that is also meaning sweet. What is a sweet kind of attention? Quite the opposite of the voyeur. Anyway, I'm going to skip that and go to my last examples, which I think are perhaps most, will be of most interest to philosophers. It's kind of Daniel Dennett imagery. I want to come to what I promised, and I want to take up abstraction as opposed to distraction, and ask the question about the awareness of thought, the awareness of thought at any given moment. These are extraordinary life-size photographs made by the artist Ben Jest. What is abstraction? Boethius actually pointed out quite a while ago that there are two kinds of abstraction. There's abstraction that looks sort of like Jana doing her diagrams, that is about abstemiousness, about taking of material away. But there's abstraction also meaning elsewhereness, the periphery. And what I want to argue with these photographs, what do they show us? Well, I'd say they show us, maybe Galen Strawson is right, consciousness is episodic. We fade in and out of it. It's not always there. Sometimes you know it, sometimes you don't. Where is it at any given moment? Just brilliantly, I think, shows that it is distributed. It's in the hand. There are all these books now on gut reaction, that consciousness is not necessarily, in the prefrontal lobes, but it can be in the hand, it can be in the belly that realizes that something is going on. But even that, I'd say, is not quite enough. Let's take a look at another. I have three Ben Jests to show you. I want to suggest that this isn't about identity. He's not so much interested in selfness as how we inhabit it, how we inhabit it at any given moment. It's important that these photos are not, they're constructed. They're not, sticking somebody holding a garbage can lid outside, although there's some of that as well. Instead, these photos are made up of a seamless combination of dozens of digital photos of the sitter and their immediate surroundings. that have been made to look this way. This is, you know, to create this effect. And you see it, by the way, first of all, in the preternatural clarity of the background, which you would not have in a regular photograph, and also in the curious tilting of the sidewalk. And the hands, you notice in all these cases, tend to be larger, so that they are assembled images. What does this do? Well, for one thing, it slows down us taking a look at this. It slows down the otherwise very fast identifying glance. It's a guy holding a garbage can lid. Boom, off you are to the next thing. Slows it down. And it also makes us ponder something else, namely that how just sitters have become dispersed. They become their being, I'm going to use old-fashioned language, has become dispersed in things, in cars, in trappings, in jewelry. This one, I think, is particularly powerful because if you were to draw up a plumb line from her face to her feet, you would see that she's actually not confronting the dilemma of how to fasten her bracelet. And yet, she is somewhere. She is alert. She is thinking, but where is that where? Where is the awareness of it? That's why I say it's a kind of Daniel Dennett sort of photograph, in the sense that it's a third person, where consciousness becomes a kind of third person phenomenon, and there is no I, no single ego Freudian I. A retreat, and the complexity of that retreat, I mean, this whole series, there are many others of these photographs, are potent because they show us this elusive thing that is the retreat into the privacy of thought and how varied and multifarious that is. I want to, my last slide, and then I'll simply conclude, is I've been talking about to be abstracted, the richness of that concept, but of course to point out too that other malaise of attention, or which is the lack of it. Or the fact, I mean, the difference between jest and this, unfortunately, viewers at a contemporary snapped at random at a contemporary art exhibition where, of course, nobody is paying attention to the wall, not even paying attention actually to other people. You notice how many people are on their cell phones or gazing elsewhere. And we now know, this I think is really important, after having been fed the pap of multitasking, that actually you cannot do two things at the same level of attentional competency, let alone 5 or 6 or 10. All right, what have I been doing? I've been trying to make a case for why one has to tackle head on the problem, the increasing problem of, what shall I say, the dysfunctions, not only the dysfunctionality of attention, but the fact that hardly anybody pays conscious attention to anything, and the importance of that, given the fact of its importance, its significance for really higher order thought. That is that tiny band of willed attention. There's no way, central for memory, as we saw already, but there's no way when they finally find the neural correlates of consciousness that that band is not going to be important. So I want to end with 3 points. It is extraordinarily ironic to me that the downplaying of conscious vision in a culture that is supposedly awash in imagery, especially electronic imagery, imagery of the sort that seizes you without your being aware, that key. The reason, there are many reasons this is, I think, very dangerous, but I want to say that it is shored up by research that comes from areas that one wouldn't naturally perhaps think of. And that is all the science that's devoted to self-organizing structures. If the brain, as we hear over and over again, is largely a self-repairing, self-sustaining system, and to which, by the way, with very definite reward systems, which have been targeted by very specific media, that language, I think, also is shored up by the kinds of research into self-organizing structures, nanostructures, complexity theory, smart prosthetics, genomics. And it's particularly dangerous because imaging is a central part of all system, of those systems. But you might well ask, what kinds of imaging? Automatic image data acquisition, automatic image recovery, automatic image recording and distribution, and automatic image display. Science actually had a number of articles on the problem with all of these masses of data that no one can even cast an eye over. So my final point is that I think we have lost sight of the fact that conscious vision dilates perception. It does something. Higher primates don't have it. We have it because we're human beings. And that getting pre-selective and selective attention together again, it seems to me, is something that should engage all of us. Anyway, I'll stop there. Thank you very much. Do I go into questions or there's a riposte first? There's a riposte first. Okay, fine. Thanks. I'm going to just go over here. Thank you. Oh, gosh, light.
We'll now have a short response from Lenore Metric Chen, and after that, we'll take some questions from the audience.
So your lecture has made me able to walk again. Thank you. Barbara, thank you so much for that inspired and inspiring lecture. I'm almost embarrassed to go next, but I do feel like you presented so many pieces in the mosaic of neuron, environment, and artwork, and spoke so eloquently on their textured being put together. Your lecture created a palpable excitement by balancing them together that allowed us to see their underlying reciprocity, and I thank you so much for that. My comments are going to be on some of your readings, because I didn't have the lecture per se, but I did have recommendations of what to read, and I was glad that they really intersected with the lecture. I also want to go along with what we're doing here in the comparison project and look at the idea of ineffability a little bit more closely. So most research, not only in neuroscience, but in history, culture, and surprisingly, even in art history, is based not on images, but on texts, written and spoken. They're seen as the pillars of thought. Images are used mainly only as illustration, rather than as fundamental structuring knowledge. But as Professor Stafford has brought out in one of her books, she quotes Aristotle saying that there is no thought without images. In her exploration of art and neuroscience, she finds that the path to get around a Cartesian duality, that seemingly insuperable separation between body and mind, is actually not to look for something beyond body and mind duality, but to look for something prior to language. For this, Barbara calls our attention to the primacy of images. And this is the intersection with the ineffability of our comparison project. My intention in this response, which I assure you will be only 15 minutes long, and then we'll have time for questions, is to pull out the thread of ineffability and, following it, offer a bit of summary on Barbara's insights into the interface of neurobiology and of art. My intention is to follow this thread through the ideas we've just heard and see how it ultimately leads us to the humanism that we discover, or rediscover rather, confirmed in your theory. Because, as I said, I didn't have the lecture in hand, I've made a summary based on writings. So my response will examine ineffability in three related questions that were raised in the lecture. One, what do we know when we see? In other words, I'll look at embodied perception. Two, the second question is about the interface of neurobiology and the outer world. What is the form of that information? And third, why is being aware that you are aware important? Why is it important that images are generative and shareable? This brings in social factors, especially empathy, and emphasizes that we are not able to be fully human without one another. So to the first, the body embodied. In other words, the body and the environment. Professor Stafford has emphasized consciousness as a concentration of awareness towards something. Through the model she has presented, she makes us aware of how thinking arises from motor action, that it's always related to movement in the body. In her book, she states very clearly, quote, "Thinking is both an acquired activity and a configurative performance." In other words, consciousness is embodied attention. Another way of saying this is that perception requires physical involvement. Our perceptions link us with our environment. We reverberate with our environment and it through us. But the model of thinking and of being that Professor Stafford has presented this evening is not one of a stream. She speaks instead of, quote, "the flickering oscillation of perception and of attention." And she says, "we resonate with echoes and rhythms." Because of this, we find an important consequence, the illusion of continuity. There are two such illusions of continuity. The first, that vision is continuous, and its equally illusory partner, our conviction of first-person consciousness as being a continuous stream. I think her photographs eloquently showed, more than my words can say, that she has presented us with a different model, one that is not smooth and continuous, but takes into account this oscillation, this continual vibration. In this mode, vision and self are interrupted. The newer model emphasizes not only the message, but also the stillness of the gap between messages. In fact, said more accurately, stillness is also part of the message that we receive. As Professor Stafford makes clear, she quote would be, "for both perception and cognition, deliberative awareness lies in the stillness of the gap." So in this stillness that is part of cognition, we first encounter the ineffable. Because we can use words to say the positive, but we cannot use words to define this negative space. We cannot speak the gap. Moving then quickly, maybe too quickly, but I do want you to have time for questions. We're at the second of the three questions, the interface of neurobiology and the outer world. What is the form of that information? Barbara Stafford makes clear that images are not pictures that form in our mind like a decorative after effect of thought. Instead, she takes seriously Aristotle's claim, cited at the beginning of my response, that there is no thought without images. At the heart of this is the radical understanding of images, not as decorations, but as units that do work. Images perform knowledge. They are the process with which we acquire knowledge. Professor Stafford talks about the construction of thought as resembling that of heraldic imagery, and I think that's a really wonderful image to keep in mind, so that it's composed of various parts that are brought together but never form a seamless, complete whole. Her description of images as boundary events is laden with significance. Images, especially those that are made in discrete parts like emblems and mosaics, are themselves the interface where world and subject get co-constructed. This means that we receive perceptions not in the form of wholeness, but that they arrive piecemeal. Each of us performs their integration and their unity. The integration of our outer context, our environment, with our inner self, our neurobiology, is in part why we experience ourselves in two major ways. We experience ourselves both from the inside as a subject, but we also see ourselves from the outside as an object. Professor Stafford observed that self-consciousness and context consciousness are shown to be inextricable, which is something that any person who has ever suffered from embarrassment can attest to. That embarrassing moment is in a moment of extreme awareness from both inside and outside. Here again, we encounter ineffability. Professor Stafford portrays our construction of knowledge as occurring without textual narration, indeed, without even a narrative visual image. Instead, we receive discrete bits of non-similar stimuli that we actively engage in binding together, which becomes our knowledge. This construction challenges the established hypothesis that language determines thought. Instead, it supports neurobiology's recent findings that humans learn to express language through concepts already present in their prelinguistic systems. In other words, the necessary representational apparatus for cognitive operations pre-exists our exposure to speech. In piecing together, seeing produces knowledge, and that knowledge is necessarily ineffable because it's prior to language. Coupling together separate components requires work, and that work is attention. Attention is a key. Professor Stafford wrote that when you open your eyes and actively interrogate the visual scene, what you see is that aspect or the physical fragments of the environment that you perform. And she spoke about this point in her lecture tonight. In this performance, in which fragments are linked through attention, the consequence is that the self is fastened to the changeable outer world in every moment. But since we are always given more data than we can possibly process, each one of us is constantly selecting components with which to construct our world. This can be accomplished, as Professor Stafford talked about tonight, either not consciously, like sleepwalking, not making choices or selection, or through what she has called an acute wakefulness. Our tendency is to rely on unconscious rather than aware vision. And increasingly today, as she so eloquently talked about, we are encouraged to become unconscious most of the time of most of what we see. But people involved in complex cognitive activities, she talked about thinking and observing and communicating, they slow down, they pause, they hesitate. And as she said, this slowness, this deliberation, is the opposite of the type of distracted vision that is part of multitasking. And she pointed out the enormous value to cognition provided by visual art. Artworks encourage attention. To attend to what they exhibit, we have to slow down and concentrate. This facilitates developing a sense of self, a self-consciousness that, as she says, is not easily swallowed up in immersive systems. This careful attention enables knowledge to grow. By reincorporating volition and effort into vision, we can turn the world into one of our own making. But what is the world we are making? And now we arrive at the crux, the end of the questions posed at the beginning. Why is being aware that you are aware important? Why do we need to be conscious that we are conscious? We turn to the question in another way. And we can ask, why go outside in search of a framing context or reality in the first place? Professor Stafford answers this by inviting us to consider what kinds of situations we wish to extend because we want to live them longer. What are the sorts of experiences that you want to be fully alert for and to be awake for? Which ones do you want to protract indefinitely? The answer can be found in the significance of our capacity for empathy, our ability to infer another person's subjective experience. This is based upon the action that Professor Stafford terms reciprocal seeing, the involuntary duplicating of another person's behavior. Empathy is both other-oriented and self-aware. Because of this, it allows us to attain a correlation between inner and outer experience. And as she pointed out, empathy is not only something automatic. It is also a social skill. It allows us to move outside our own physical boundary by bringing other beings into our stream of images. The purpose of this intertwining is not just for spectacle, watching people like on the television news. The capacity for empathy does not just allow us to behold others, but to engage purposefully with others. The connection between vision and what lies outside is the pathway to empathetic understanding, and it eschews words. The importance of being aware of our understanding of the world through images and neuroscience, our ineffable understanding, I'd say for Tim's benefit, is urgently and eloquently stated in Professor Stafford's book, A Field Guide to a New Metafield. I end by turning to Barbara's words, and this is a quote. Developing responsible citizens means training our volition so that we are not just blindly led by our reward systems. We need to complicate the current conception of vision and images, making them commensurate with an unsettling present filled with equivocal entities and ambiguous situations. Thank you very much. And at this point, we'll turn it over to questions, and Barbara will come back to it.
Not so fast. I'm sorry, just gonna get this bloody light. I want to thank Barbara Stafford for a masterful lecture, and Lenore for a very thoughtful, articulate response. I was hoping to get some advice along the way about how to get my kids to pay attention to me. But no. I did maybe want to give Barbara first chance to respond to Lenore, if you'd like, or if not, we can move directly into questions from the audience. And maybe, Lenore, you want to be up here for this as well, in case some of the questions are for you?
I think maybe the audience has been very patient. What do you think, Lenore?
I really appreciate that, but I do agree that I will have a chance to talk to Barbara, and this is a chance for people to engage.
Okay.
I want to thank you so much.
Very good. I've been overruled. I'll step aside here. please.
Professor Stafford, I was wondering if you think there's a group of fundamental compelling images that demand our slow attention that cross cultures and history and perhaps are part of our inherited subconscious.
Well, it's a wonderful, wonderful question, and I guess I'm going to, the way, I mean, it's also very, very complicated. Obviously, I stuck with the Western tradition. I'd say that maybe a way to begin to answer you, sorry, I should be talking into this thing, is to say that I'm also a neuro-Darwinist, and I think the way somebody like Gerald Edelman, in a way of answering, way of getting at it, he talks about the fact that we're all born with a primary repertoire. It's too big. And as individuals living within an environment, we shape it into what's called the secondary repertoire. And so the way I would answer that question is that different cultures shape the secondary repertoire. There are things that are hardwired. I mean, I don't care what happens, you know, like these people, you know, Hoffman and all these people, Shepherd, who study mind games, optical illusions. You have it. I don't care where. If you're in New Guinea, you have it. But I think the direction might be that way. That is to look more into the ways in which that secondary repertoire gets shaped. I look at it, actually, in the field guide. Edelman stresses, the interesting thing is that there's always this exchange with the environment that leads to the shaping of the secondary repertoire. But the thing is, the way something comes in from the environment isn't the way it goes out again. It goes out intensified. And I look at that in terms of what's happening with newer media, the way in which we're conditioned, say, for more and more violence, more and more speed. But I think your question, I'm sorry, I don't mean to go on, but I think your question raises the possibility for really intelligent ways of thinking about what we all have in common and where and how we differ. So thank you for that. That's a lovely and very hard question. Yes?
My question relates to the coda echo objects. How do you see empathy relating to the what you say the law-like aspects of art? And
the what?
The law-like aspects of art?
Oh.
And how would you, would there be possible differences that empathy would arise in cultures that have individually competitive organizations or a communistic organization?
Oh my God, I don't know. The second part, let me just do the first part first. I try to make the, you two are got quite a few things together and what. I try to make the argument that there are law-like aspects to art. Now, this might be a shock to many people who think art is, you know, anything goes. And especially to art historians, you know, who also have kind of ignored that. And the empathetic issue would come up. I mean, it has to do, I know it's overused, this concept of mirror neurons, of mimicry, that we have to have some way of intuiting. You look at someone, this would be Tim's topic, without speech. You look at someone and you don't talk. Maybe you don't know the same language, but you have to begin to intuit something about what's going on inside. The interesting thing about the law-likeness is that that's kind of a law. I mean, that is about the way a behavioral law. What's interesting is to see how it's thwarted. There are art movements, for example, that thwart that quite deliberately. You can think of the surrealists, Dadaists, where everything is, but you can't thwart a law unless you know it, unless it exists, if you see what I'm saying. So that there are artists who deliberately thwart that natural impulse, if you will, to move out into space and to try and intuit something about another person, just as there are artists who actually play it up, who play up the recognition factor, the ease of that. And Lenore very kindly mentioned this aspect of my Echo Objects book, which almost killed me, writing, but where I try to argue that there are certain, to me, it's not that there aren't any neuroscientists out there who are interested in art. They're particularly interested in one kind of art, Magritte. In artists, no, but it's important because what does Magritte do? He plays with optical illusions. You see it, there's no way of getting around it. But what they ignore are all these movements in artists who actually are about thwarting optical illusions. And that's what I meant when I speak about laborious art, emblems, mosaics, things where you are aware, montage, collage, where you are aware that you've got all these pieces and you bloody hell have to put them together. They're not being put together for you. Those are non-illusory art forms. And they're not things that you're necessarily empathetic to because you can't see what the thing is until you perform it and construct it. So if that in any way begins to get to where you are, the communism part, I need a drink before I answer that. Just, sorry. But thank you for the question. Yes?
In some of your images, you talk about elements that make us slow down and take notice.
Yes, yes.
I'm wondering how you would incorporate those elements into, say, textbook images of a neuron talking to a neuron or a brain slice. A lot of your images deal with people, and I think we're drawn to see bigger hands and slanted sidewalks. What do your theories say about how you would incorporate your ideas?
The electron microscope.
Into textbook images that would make students and readers slow down and pay attention to the images in the book.
Gosh.
That's a really interesting question, given that we have so, I mean, the new invisible, the new infinity goes down, it's, you know, and up, and of course, abstraction reigns. It's really, I would say, I mean, I really have to think about this, but I would say that there are certain strategies, which actually the history of art is really filled with, just as I said, there's just as I explained here. They're labor-intensive genres, and they're genres that aren't. But pictorial strategies that actually make it clear that this is an area worth attending to. Now, I'm thinking of books. Now, Edward Tufte's Chart Junk. You know, if you think of somebody like Edward Tufte, who points out the beauty of 18th century cartography, I mean, those maps got you somewhere. And also, when he's writing about all, I actually read science rather regularly. I look at these images, I'm thinking, who in the hell devised this? Because you can't read, you know, the way in which this whole thing's set up, and of course, false color, all of this stuff obfuscates rather than clarifies. So I think that not reducing, I never reduce images to illustrations. You know me, then my work, you know, that's anathema. But there's a way in which images can help co-construct the kind of information. Are you a scientist? Are you? You are. Well, it's a wonderful question because you know there are huge problems with scientific, quote-unquote, illustrations, and their misuse. I actually sat on some NSF panels about that, so... But it's a beautiful question, but I would direct you first. I mean, one would have to work on it. One would have to do a collaborative project and understand. What kind of a scientist are you?
Chemistry.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. I mean, there's a beauty, by the way, to those old models, you know, the old, you know, sort of Lego block and models. But I understand you're inhabiting a different world. No, it's really a major, major issue. And I would begin by saying that one has to blast out and realize that the world of art has many different formats, and not all forms do the same thing. They don't. They do different things, just like all, not all media do the same thing. We're encouraged to think, you know, everything is reducible to a photograph. I would say that some of those chemical atoms and so on might still be better served with sculpture. Or they might be better served as another prototype in which they might be modeled. But thank you. That's a beautiful question.
Yes?
One of the things that I guess your argument is premised on, and I would like to hear you address like what I think is the next step in how that might relate to neuroscience is this. You are privileging secondary repertoire, higher level of thought, and this is and part of what you're blaming is technology But this is actually a very old argument ever since the bread circuses, plebeians, you know, the low art versus high art thing. And so what I'm kind of interested in is, what do you think, if this higher order of attention is important, is it important for everyone, and is technology and or cognitive science, where can we go with it in terms of maybe cultivating that in greater portions of people, which it hasn't historically really been given to?
Well, thank you for that question. I think, first of all, it's important to recognize it's a problem. That is, there's a problem that that tiny little band we've got, where supposedly, for the theologians, free will, you know, is also very much under discussion. I would say categorically, everybody needs to have some use of that selective attention, and the problem is it's being whittled away. I mean, that's my argument. I think educators, so I'm not going to go to your point, need to address this really head on. I have to say I travel a great deal, and I've also had the privilege of being a guest professor in different places. One thing that has struck me is how our classrooms have changed. At Georgia Tech, I do not permit laptops. I don't permit. I'm just going to give you this example. I've sat, and they brought in the head of Microsoft and so on. Do you think they're paying attention to the head of Microsoft? Forget it. The students are doing their emails. No one pays attention. And, of course, it happens also in the classroom now, unless you ban it. I am not a Luddite. I'm not a Luddite. But I do believe that we're really in rather a terrible moment. And I think that it has to be addressed head on. So I do certain things. As I said, I don't permit it. It caused almost a revolution at Tech when I said, put it away. I don't want to see it. And I had to even get a different classroom because they have them wired in the classroom. So, you know, the students would be looking at me like this. So that I think we have to, I mean, you're asking a very, very profound pedagogical question. I think we need to, first of all, recognize that it's an issue, explain to the students why it's an issue, make it compelling, and then go forward. And my students accepted it. I just think it's an uphill battle, and everyone has to engage in it. And yes, everybody needs it. Especially since cognitive scientists and neuroscientists are part of the staff of Microsoft, of Word, of all of these companies. The reward systems might be something that sounds, you know, exotic to a humanist, but it doesn't sound exotic to these designers. So I don't know what else I can say except that it has to be addressed head on. A cell-free zone. You know.
Piggybacking off of that question, by the way, I loved the slides and all the artwork. It was really great to be introduced to so many different artists. I'm curious, you're talking about different types of literacies.
Yes.
And, you know, from Walter Ong to Greg Ong.
Sure.
These kind of new ideas, and Mark Turner.
Right.
Is this kind of concept of new types of literacies that are based off of kind of oral traditions, you know, literary traditions, and then electricity as Ulmer.
Yeah, Ulmer, Greg. I know Greg, yes, for sure, sure.
And I'm curious because your argument sounds very nostalgic for something that is gone.
I don't believe in nostalgia, so I'm sorry to hear that.
I'm wondering, you know, if we think about Ulmer in terms of electricity.
Yes.
You know,
or Kate Hales, you know, Electra. Yeah, sure.
Of thinking about, in fact, the way in which thinking has changed, and maybe we actually have, and our students are actually engaging in new kinds of hybrid thinking and might we kind of adapt to their kind of new ways of cognition? And so I'm curious about that. In addition, so many of your slides and such have these kind of implied narratives.
Mm.
And so like the notion of stasis and attention is really interesting. But I'm also wondering about like the last slides, because Dennett, they seemed very narrative.
No, I said it was a kind of Daniel Dennett like photograph, in the sense that it wasn't first person, but third distributed cognition.
I was curious about the way in which Brecht challenged narrative by virtue of stopping the play. The surrealists stopped a film for 5 or 10 minutes. But all of
or Andy Warhol slept for 24 hours.
Sure. But I'm curious about the relationship also between narrative and stasis and what constitutes attention within a kind of larger ideological framework. Because can we attend to the detail within a larger ideological
within framework? Narrative, of course, and there are narrative structures, by the way, that are modeled on pictorial structures, and I write about that quite a bit in Echo Objects. I write quite a bit about Ezra Pound, for example, about imagism, but others as well. And in the case of episodic consciousness, people like Montaigne, I mean, there's a whole tradition of writing that in a way is really grounded more in pictorial practice than it is really in sort of the narrative, a kind of linear narrative. Please don't get me wrong. I'm not even making the media argument that is that it's just the visual sense. I'm also interested in a whole new philosophy of the senses, the fact, and I tried to bring in the haptic and scent and things like that. So I'm not denying that. I admire the work of Greg Ulmer. And I think there was a kind of utopianism in that work, because Greg is also he's also very thoughtful. I wonder if one sat him down today, whether he would, I don't know, whether he would be so totally smitten by the level of speed and control, the kind of cybernetic control, the fact that our students are all engaged with this. I don't think that's an argument against what I'm saying. I think it's wonderful, all the new media interactions. I'm not a Luddite, as I said, but I do think this is an area, among others, that needs attention. So I don't know how else to say it. And I certainly don't exclude literature in the sense of also fostering attentiveness. No way. I mean, there are all sorts of rather interesting devices, again, formal strategies in the literary text to do that. So I understand that. No. I'm just saying I understand that. But I don't think that students know it all. And I don't know. Beyond that, I don't know what to say, but thank you for the question. Thank you for the observation.
That might be all the time we have for questions. Please join me in thanking Professor Stafford.
Thank you.